All right. Well, good evening, everybody. Wonderful. I hope you are all staying warm. Whew. Some nice chilly temperatures the last few days here in Maryland, even in Virginia, I'm sure. It's not that far. She's got her hood on. There you go. Okay. We are continuing our travels through Pirkei Avot. And I want to share with you tonight's Mishnah, which is chapter one, Mishnah number four. And we're going to read the whole thing. And then, as we've done in the past, we're going to examine it. I'll give you a little background to it and some insights. So, Mishnah number four reads as follows: Yosi, the son of Yoezer from Tzreda, and Yosi, the son of Yochanan of Yerushalayim, they received the tradition from them. Them. We'll see in a moment. Yosi, the son of Yoezer of Tzreda, would say, "Let your home be a meeting place for the wise. Dust yourself in the soil of or the dust of your of their feet and drink thirstily of their words." Okay, we're going to go through this step by step, but let's start again. If you recall, the first three Mishnayot, the first one gave us a history lesson from the time Moses received the Torah at Mount Sinai. We were all there. These ethics, these values that we're going to discuss in this tractate, this Mishnah called Pirkei Avot, was already from God, from Torah at Sinai. And he gave it over to his disciple Joshua, to the elders, to the prophets, and that. And then the men of the great assembly were taught us three things. Then we saw Mishnah Beis, which told us Shimon the righteous, Shimon HaTzadik, was one of the last surviving members of the great assembly. He taught us something. Then last week we learned Mishnah Gimel. Antignus, the man of Socho, he received the tradition from Shimon HaTzadik. So far, we got this all straight. Teacher to student becomes the teacher, passes it on to the next student. Now we come to Mishnah 4, Mishnah Daled. Yosi, the son of Yoezer, and Yosi, the son of Yochanan, received the tradition from them. So please note, first of all, that it is no longer a singular person. It's now a tag team. Two people. Yosi, the son of Yoezer, and Yosi, the son of Yochanan, two different people, receive the tradition. Who were you expecting to see? The one who was quoted in the previous Mishnah, Antignos, right? That's how we follow the pattern. But here it says, these two men, Yosi ben Yoezer and Yosi ben Yochanan, receive the tradition from them in the plural. Who's the them? So, question number one is why is it a pair? And number two is who's the them? Before we even get to the teachings from the two of them. So, let me give you a little historical background. As we mentioned, it does go from teacher to student, and it continued that way for many, many generations. However, this is now the time period of the Second Temple, the Second Beit HaMikdash. And unfortunately, while it was a wonderful reunion, so to say, after the first temple was destroyed and we were exiled into Babylonia, ultimately we were taken over by the Persians. The story of Purim and the victory over Haman and Ahasuerus brought us back to the land of Israel. We were able to rebuild the second Beit HaMikdash, the second temple. However, the sages point out that it was not of the same spiritual level that temple number one was on. Things were definitely good, but not great. For example, the actual Ark of the Covenant, the Aron Kodesh, which housed the tablets, was not there in the Second Temple. It had been hidden away at the end before the First Temple was destroyed. It was hidden away, and it was not returned for the Second Temple. The positions of high priest, Kohen Gadol, as time went on during the second Beit HaMikdash, it definitely lost its position of prominence because it wasn't earned anymore. The Talmud tells us that as things began to unravel further and further and further as time went on, believe it or not, the position of the Kohen Gadol was auctioned off. The highest bidder, which is a crying shame, because the position of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, was supposed to be the highest ranking spiritual leader for the Jewish people. much more than the two people we're about to discuss in a moment, those two positions. But there was a Kohen Gadol, and then there was someone in charge, what we call the Sanhedrin, the judicial branch. You had, so to say, the executive branch. That was more, the Kohen Gadol's role. He was leading the people from a spiritual perspective and policies. But also there was now the Sanhedrin, the judicial branch. Within the Sanhedrin, there were two players. I don't mean names of people, two positions. One was known as the Nasi, the prince. He was, I don't know, Nasi nowadays means the president, right? Nasi HaMedina, or Nasi HaMemshala, is the term for the president of Israel. The Nasi, he was we'll call him the president. And then there was someone called the Av Beit Din, the head of the court. They shared the mantle of leadership. Kohen Gadol had the spiritual aspect, and the head of the Sanhedrin, the head of the Beit Din, the court, together with the Nasi, they had a shared position of leadership. From this point on, from our Mishnah Dalet going forward, is going to be pairs. They lived at the same time. The first one in the pair was always the Nasi. He was the prince, he was the president. And the second in the pair was the Av Beit Din, the head of the court. But they shared that it was a dual leadership. I'll read you from two different works here. One, again, I love to quote Rabbi Wein, again, great historian who has a great intro to many of these people who may, many of whom we have not heard of. He writes the following. He writes, Antigonus from Mishnah 3 transmitted the tradition of Torah to these two great men. They are the first of the zugot. Zugot means pairs. A zug is a pair. So zugot are now the system of pairs who led the nation during the transitional period, starting from the founders of the Second Commonwealth, continuing through the Hasmoneans, the story of Hanukkah, which is about 150 years before the destruction of the Second Temple. The total time period of the Second Temple was 420 years. So if the Hashmoneim, the story of Hanukkah, takes place approximately 150 years before its destruction, so you're looking at approximately 280, 290 years of this time period of where you had this dual leadership. And ending with the rise of the early Tanaim, those from the Mishnah, and the Roman domination over Judea and the Jews. Jewish leadership during this time was concentrated in the offices of the high priest and the heads of the Sanhedrin. The pairs were the two main leaders of the Sanhedrin, one serving as the Nasi, the executive authority, and the other as the Av Beit Din, the judicial procedural head of the court. Exactly like I said, Rabbi Wein copied it ex off of my paper. Okay. The period of the Zugos extended for more, as I said, more than 2 centuries, and the system of Sanhedrin leadership provided an alternative government to the absence of Jewish temporal authority, so to speak, for Jewish society in a very uncertain and turbulent period. You have to make a mental note that while it was nice to have the Second Temple, it was not a calm, very positive experience in Jewish history. Things were continuing to unravel till ultimately it was destroyed and we were exiled ever since. That's Rabbi Wein's take. But I want to share it with you something from the Maharal of Prague. Many of you have heard me quote him before. He says similar, same idea, but he adds one more piece, which I thought was very apropos. He says the change in leadership, moving from a singular leader to a paired leadership, this mirrored the ongoing decline in national unity. The role that had been filled by a unified leadership was now a divided and shared responsibility. This divided leadership, shared by pairs of rabbis, was fitting for the era of the Second Temple, a time that was marked by growing factionalism within society. We as a people were beginning to splinter apart. Now, you knew that was coming. You may not have put the pieces together, but now that I said it, it will make perfect sense. Let's review for a moment. Why the Talmud identifies and wants to know what was the underlying cause for the first and second temples to be destroyed? What was going on in society that God felt that we were no longer worthy of having his presence dwell among us, and therefore we were exiled? So the Talmud says, okay, what did they do wrong during First Temple era? The Talmud says the Jewish people were sinning in the most cardinal sin. They were sinning with adultery, idolatry, and murder. Three cardinal sins in Judaism. There was rampant disregard for basic Torah law. Talmud says, okay, that was not the case during Temple 2. Why was the second temple destroyed? We all know this. What does the Talmud say? Because of sinat chinam, what was commonly translated as baseless hatred. There was a breakdown of Jewish society. We couldn't get along with each other. Not because we weren't learning Torah, not because we weren't following the mitzvot. That's not what the Talmud says. There was a breakdown in interpersonal relationships within our own people. Once you put this all together, now I understand that if the end of the Second Temple, it reached the crescendo of where we couldn't even get along with each other, there was no basis to go ahead and to hate. The Talmud doesn't use poetic language. When the Talmud says there was sinah, hatred, it doesn't mean he wasn't my favorite friend. He wasn't my BFF. Or I can't believe he didn't friend me on Facebook. That's not what they're talking about. They're talking about where there was a real, I can't be in the room with you. I can't even listen to what you have to say. We are so apart from each other ideologically, philosophically, religiously, you name it. We just can't get along. Now I understand. What leads to something like that? It doesn't happen overnight. That's over generations and generations. This Mishnah is our first clue of things beginning to decline, of where there wasn't this mantle of leadership to be able to guide the whole people. Now we're starting to break off into pieces. Okay, you'll oversee this part and you'll oversee that part. And we're going to start to see arguments, disagreements with each other. If you've ever had the opportunity to study different sections of Mishnah or Talmud, it's almost a rarity to find a Mishnah without someone in the Mishnah disagreeing with what was just said. It's almost impossible. It'll start with a sentence. You know, I'm learning the tractate Sukkah now, and it talks about what you can, you know, about a lulav, about if it's already dried out, right? So it says a dried out lulav is no good. Reb Meir says, no, it's okay. I'm like, okay, that's classic Mishnah, classic Talmud. A says one thing, B says something else. Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai, over. Right? This is nonstop. This is the beginning of that era of where, because you don't have a unified leadership, it's reflective of a lack of a unified people. This is where our Mishnah now begins. Okay? So, Yossi ben Yoezer and Yossi ben Yochanan received the traditions from the previous two. Remember, it said from them, meaning from Antigonus, who got it from Shimon HaTzadik. Yeah. Shimon HaTzadik lived a very long life. So much so that Antigonus, his student who learned from him, was also around and was able to teach it to their students. So they received the tradition from the two of them. Now let's see what he says. It's important to recognize what's being said here. Yossi ben Yoezer, the first in our pair, tells us three things. Number one, Yihi beitcha beit vad lachachamim. Let your home be a meeting place for the wise. Let your home be a meeting place for the wise. Again, as I like to do, I want to share with you different ideas, not just one. Because it's open for a lot of interpretation here. Let's start with basics. Let me start with this. I think that what this Mishnah has one objective, one theme, and the question is, how does one bring Torah into their home? How can I make my home a Torah home? Now, some of you, many of you, were part of our group. I think it was just last year or maybe even 2 years ago. We did a whole theme on the Jewish home. And we went room by room showing how every aspect of our home, from the steps leading up to our house, to the fence that we put up, to the mezuzah on the door, to the mitzvah of welcoming guests into the dining room, and the kosher food in the kitchen, and how we behave in the bedroom. There's no place in your home that Torah can't permeate or shouldn't. It should permeate. Comes along Yossi, the son of Yoezer, and he says, how does one do this practically? How can one bring Torah into the home? So he gives you a three-tiered answer. Number one, let your home, and we're going to explain each one. Let your home be a meeting place for the wise. You should sit in the dust of their feet when they're there. Don't be busy in the kitchen or be busy looking up something else. If you have sages in your house, utilize them. Sit nicely at their feet, hearing what they have to say, and drink thirstily of their words. We're going to break it down each one of these, but I believe this is one objective. How can I practically bring Torah into my home? So,
And you found the key for why we're all here tonight.
exactly. So, Jeff, you're touching on the point really what I'm going to get to, and that is how do we do this in today's world? Right? In the old days, there was no communication like we have now. They didn't have a forum called Zoom of where you can sit comfortably in your home and I'm in comfortably in my home and we can share Torah over the medium like this is amazing. They didn't have that. The only way that they could possibly have Torah in their home was literally to bring a sage into their house. How else were you going to have it? So number one is that you have to actually have scholars, Torah people, come into your home. Or at least, let me say it this way, to make your home inviting that a guest of that caliber would be comfortable being there. I had the opportunity when I was living in Columbus. So we had a we were I was part of a Kollel. I was part of an education resource center. And obviously, for many, many reasons, we had to be, I'll say it this way, we had to be careful in whose homes we were allowed to eat. Not everybody kept a standard of kosher. Not everybody kept kosher at all. And our interaction obviously put us in touch with people who didn't. So we had to be careful. But we wanted to do it in a way that was not, what's the word I'm looking for? To look down on people and to say, oh, we can't come to your house. No, rather, what we did is we had a simple rule. We would come to anybody's house, anybody, as long as they followed certain basic rules. The food that they had was bought from the kosher establishment in the community. That's simple enough. I won't eat anybody's homemade food, is what we said. Right? This way, nobody's insulted. If you buy it from Bexley Kosher, it's fine. And we're not going to eat on anybody's china. We're not eating on anybody. We'll have paper plates. That's it. Give everybody a break. No one has to wash dishes tonight. No dishwasher. We made it simple. We had a basic layout. And it became so nice because people would have us for dinner. And they got to see the rabbis and their families in a context that they don't normally do. We brought our families, our kids interacted with their kids. It was just a great, they felt like, wow, they were in the presence of greatness that was brought into their home. That was a real way to do it. So making it inviting that your person can have a home that people would be there is a wonderful thing. But it goes more than that. It definitely needs to go more than that. Because a meeting place for the sages, right? Let's use the words again here. Let's open up that Mishnah. I haven't figured out how you can do both at the same time, but here we go, right? He says, let your home be a meeting place for the wise. It does not say, let your home every blue moon have a sage. That means there's more of a regular basis to it. It's not a one and done. Let your home be where they know that if there's a meeting in Frederick or there's a meeting in Ashburn, Virginia, this is where I want to have my group so that I can get together, right? It's wonderful. Make your home the home where wise people come to meet on a regular basis. You should be invited into your home, throughout the home. Sages, teachers, rabbis, scholars, wise people. It doesn't only have to be rabbis. If you associate with wise people who have common sense, who give good etza, good advice on how to deal with issues, cling to them. They're great people to have in your life. So the first thing he tells us is to get Torah in your life, get Torah in your home, associate with those who represent Torah. But Jeff says, what about nowadays? It's not every day that you can have the rabbi come. It's not practical. We don't live in a shtetl anymore. The rabbi doesn't necessarily come around the houses anymore. You know, every now and then the rabbi, like doctors, make house calls, but typically they don't. So how does one do it? So if you're not able to bring the scholars in, then bring their texts in. Bring in their books. You've heard me talk about this many, many times. I am a very big believer and a very big advocate for a Jewish Torah library. One needs to have Jewish books in their home. And I don't mean just the coffee table size ones that just are there for good looks. I mean have a chumash. Every Jewish home has to have a chumash. Every Jewish home has to have a siddur, a prayer book, the Torah. You gotta have basics. And nowadays, with the amount of availability of almost anything in whatever language you want, it's incredible. But that's not it, because the explosion of technology has made it that you almost have to go out of your way not to find something in Torah on the internet. I recommend, write this down. If you have a smartphone, there's an app called TorahAnytime.com. Torah, TORAH. Next words, it's one word. Anytime. If I have to spell it for you, we got a problem. TorahAnytime.com. You can go online, you can listen to it on your computer. If you have a smartphone, you get the app. When I travel, when I go anywhere, I listen to somebody talking Torah. It's literally at your fingertips. I'm not talking about only high-level classes. I'm talking about from the basics of basics to the highest of the high and everything in between. It's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of speakers who have thousands and thousands of Torah lessons to share. There's no excuse in the world why we can't bring Torah into our homes. What you're doing right now is bringing Torah into your home. You are bringing a level of sanctity into your home. You can't see the Torah molecules, but they're flying all over the place. They're there. They're there. And they're mounting week after week after week. The level of sanctity in your home gets a boost every Wednesday night at 8. And many other nights, I'm sure you're doing as well. But what's available is truly amazing. I love doing home groups, right? Not everybody, okay, sometimes you don't want to do Zoom. It happens to be this class works that way. I like the personal touch. I love doing home groups. I've been doing it for almost 30 years, wherever I go. What's so great about it? It brings a level of Torah literally into the home. Okay. But let's appreciate this even further. Many of you may remember, maybe not, but when we first started that series, I gave you a little introduction, an introduction about the importance of having a Jewish home. Let's see what I mean by that. The Talmud says the following. The Talmud says that if you look, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob all made reference to the Temple Mount area. They all had interactions with it, but they each referred to them with a different name. The Talmud says that Abraham referred to that area as a har, a mountain. As he said, on the mountain, Hashem Yera, Bahar Hashem Yera'eh, on the mountain on which God will appear. Will be seen. His connection with the Temple Mount area was that of a mountain. Yitzhak, He referred to it as a sadeh, as we had just in last week's parsha. When Rivka was coming to meet Yitzchak for the first time, it says that Yitzchak was out lasuach basadeh, conversing in the field, which meant he was praying. Where, which field? The Talmud tells us that was in the Temple Mount area. And then you come to this week's parsha of where Jacob is had to run away from his brother Esau, who wants to kill him. Yetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva. Yaakov leaves and he's on his way to Haran. He wants to go out there to his uncle Lavan's house. And sure enough, what happens? He goes to sleep. He has this dream of what? Come on, folks. What does he have a dream of?
The ladder.
A ladder. A
Angels
ladder
going
that
up and
goes
down the
from the
ladder.
ground all the way up to heaven. And he sees angels going up and going down, right? All of this. Fabulous. He wakes up from his Shluff, he wakes up from his dream, and what does he say? He couldn't believe it. Ein zeh ki im beit Elokim. This is nothing other than the house of God. Where was this? Yeah, this is exactly where we're talking, the Temple Mount area. So Avram refers to it as a mountain, Yitzchak refers to it as a field, and Yaakov's association is that of a house. Interesting observation, right? What could possibly be the lesson be? And the part two of it is what do we call it? What do we call the house? Oh, see, I gave it away. What do we call what the temple stood? We call it the Beit
House.
HaMikdash.
House of
Beit
God.
HaMikdash is the house of sanctity. Well, why isn't it called Har HaMikdash, the mountain of sanctity, or Sadeh HaMikdash? The field of, we make the reference like Yaakov, it's a home. Why? What is the difference between mountain, field, and home? So, if you analyze this carefully, what you find is as follows. The function of the temple really had three functions. Number one was like a mountain. It was a place to ascend to, a place to look up to, a place that could inspire a person to feel I'm in the presence of God. If you've ever been to the Kotel in Israel, if you've ever been there's just a certain feel you have. Not everybody feels it there. Some people feel it in Hebron by the Cave of Machpelah. Some feel it in Beit Lechem by Rachel's tomb. Everybody feels it somewhere. But what that feeling is that you just, it's something going through you. It's those Torah molecules, by the way. It's that sanctity that you just, your soul is picking up on it. It's almost like, if you have these radiation testers. So if you're a mile away, it chimes a little bit. You get closer and closer, it's like it's going off the charts. It's off the meter. The closer you are to the source of sanctity, bam, it's off the meter. So Avraham sees the Beit HaMikdash area, the Temple Mount area, as like a mountain, this lofty thing that you're inspired. You look up and it's like, wow, I want to ascend. I want to be at the top of this mountain. It was on my bucket list, but I think recently I've revised it. I don't think Mount Kilimanjaro is going to be on my bucket list anymore. But it was once upon a time. I would love to do that. Okay, that's one area. Number two is that the temple also filled the function like a field. What's a field? A field is a place for growth and development. Yes, you put work into it, but it by its very nature is the environment that nurtures growth. You think of a field, you think of something growing. I love the drive to Shoresh. Why? Because you pass all these fields, and every year, we're like, okay, what are we passing this year? What are they planting? This year it's corn. Next year it's winter rye. The year after that it's soybean. And like, it's nonstop. It's always growing. It's growing, it's growing, it's growing. So, too, you go to a Beit HaMikdash, there's a sense of growth. Many people don't know this, but there's actually a law. And it's quoted in the book of the prophets. It's not in the code of Jewish law because we don't have a temple. But the rule was that if you came in via into the temple via the northern entrance, you had to go out the southern and vice versa. If you came in the southern, you got to go out the northern. You do not exit the way you entered. Why? That seems like a little strange, but that in your Trivial Pursuit Torah edition. question. Like, why? Why would that be? So they tell us, the commentaries point out, because if you can exit the same way you entered and you got nothing, you're just the same person the way you came out as the way you went in, you missed the whole point of being there. You got to come out different. Going to the Kotel, going into the temple itself, experiencing an opportunity for growth like that, and you came out the same way, shame on you. That's a no-no. Therefore, you go in one way, you got to come out another way. You have to be changed. That's like a field nurturing growth and development. So we understand mountain, the idea of ascending or looking up to aspire to be like. Number two is like a field of nurturing growth and development. But ultimately, Yaakov sees it as a house, a home. What makes a home a home? It encompasses everything. A home, basically, in its most simplistic way, is four walls, a door, maybe even a window. That's it. A roof over your head, maybe, right? That's it. What is the function of the walls? The walls really create a certain, it does two things. Number one, it creates an interior area. It creates a private domain, an inner sanctum that's separated from the public. We need to create an environment of Jewish values and morals in our inner sanctum, our home. And when the walls are meant for us to be within. This is how our home is. Every single person on this call knows, and you have made your indelible mark on what your home should look like from a decor standpoint. Everybody here has done that, whether it was you or your spouse, but somebody did it. You didn't just move in and say, yeah, okay, that's the way it goes. No, you wanted it to look a certain way, and you spend time and money that it should be the way you want. What makes us think that for our inner sanctum of holiness, it should be any different? I want my home to reflect the values that I hold dear. The walls allow me to say, this is what's on the inside. This is my inner sanctum of spirituality, right? That serves as the foundation of my Torah life. But it also, as a corollary of that, it also acts as a unifier of those who are within the walls. We learn to interact as a family or as a unit. Without walls, you see, a mountain and a field have no walls. There's no boundaries. I got to read you this. I wasn't sure I was going to get to it, but goes in this direction that sometimes I don't even know where it's going to go. But here's what it says. Listen to this. I love this. A house, unlike a mountain or a field, has boundaries, has limits. It defines what is inside of it and what is outside of it. With a house with walls, one defines a place, and God is somehow more present in that place than outside that place. The boundaries allow for degrees of connection, degrees of intensity. Boundaries also define limits. Not all is acceptable. There are rules in a house. With those limits, however, comes caring, comes direction, comes meaning, comes love. The Beit HaMikdash was guided by a myriad of rituals and rules, but that's exactly what gave it its sanctity, its meaning. You couldn't just willy-nilly just walk anywhere you wanted in the temple. We were very, very described areas and circumscribed where I can and where I cannot. I, not being a Kohen, was limited. I cannot just go. I could be the greatest scholar of the generation. I could go down as Moses 2.0. I still cannot go to certain places in the temple. Because there are rules. The more rules you have, the more intense, the more connectivity within those rules, within those boundaries. Okay? A house we build, we put in our efforts, we put ourselves into it, and we value it, not just for what it is, but for what we've invested into it and what we value as a part of ourselves. Like I said before, if somebody walks into your house, they say, oh, that definitely has Sandy's touch. Come on, that's for sure. That's definitely got Candy's written name written all over it. There's a certain, that's their house. You know it that way, right? That's the way you walk into somebody's house and you say, that's a Jewish home. You see what's important to them. You can see it. You've invested it. Okay? It would also explain, as an aside, why the Beit HaMikdash, even to this day, retains its sanctity, but Mount Sinai, upon which the Torah was given, did not retain any sanctity whatsoever. If you want to go on a tour down in the Egyptian desert and you want to go visit Mount Sinai, wherever it is, and you want to go and hike Mount Sinai, okay, it's not Kilimanjaro, but it's close, right? You want to do that, you are more than welcome. You want to go on the Temple Mount, you better ask a few authorities. They would tell you not a good idea. Why? Because it retains sanctity. Why? Why does Mount Sinai lose its sanctity, but the Beit HaMikdash, having been destroyed over 2,000 years ago, still retains it? The answer is Mount Sinai, we invested nothing. God did everything. We stood there. We accepted it. Now I'm not downplaying it. But at the end of the day, we did not invest ourselves into it. God gave us the Torah. The Beit HaMikdash, we joined, we partnered with God, we built it. And God rested his presence, his divine presence there. That's a partnership. When we are a part of it, it retains its sanctity long past us. Our homes are no different. If we invest the sanctity into it, it outlives us. That's the beauty of it. Okay. So you have these walls of a home that allow the inner sanctum to be full of sanctity and spirituality. It serves a certain basis for the harmony within the home. In fact, marital harmony, the mitzvah of getting along with one's spouse, what's it called in Hebrew?
Shalom bias.
Shalom, keyword,
Bias.
bias. It's about the home, peace and harmony in the home. That's where it's all at. But also, the walls, they act as a buffer against any of the destructive foreign influences that we don't want in our home. My grandmother used to always say, you wipe your feet before you come in here. Don't bring that schmutz into my house. Don't bring that schmutz into my house. Now, I understood much, much later, she wasn't only talking about the physical stuff on my shoes. She also meant, don't bring the schmutz that's from outside in society that doesn't belong here. Not everything out there should be in here. Brilliant. That's what she was saying, really. The walls, the door. What's a door? What's its function? To allow things in and to keep things out. These are what makes a home a home. There are mitzvot that are specifically for a house, for a home. The lighting candles for Shabbos. Do you know what function it serves? Do you know why it's so important to light candles on Shabbos for Shabbos? Do you know why? I'm willing to bet most of you don't have the right answer. I'm curious. Why do you think you light candles for Shabbos?
You bring the Sabbath into the house.
How? You bring Sabbath? Listen, can I keep
Well,
Shabbos without candles?
you by welcoming when you light them, you kind of welcome it in.
So why don't you just put up a sign that says Shabbat Shalom?
It's a physical thing. The candles
I will
become.
put it up, Fred. I promise you. 15 minutes, 18, sorry, 18 minutes before sunset, I'm going to put up a big plaque that says Shabbat Shalom. I'm doing a physical act. Why candles?
It's something different from all the other nights. Separates
That
the
sounds like
Shabbos
Pesach.
from the week.
Okay, but
Well,
Ann, tell me, why is there some symbolism of candles
the
that might
candle
be
goes
even
up.
higher than just it's something different?
I think the light, when you light the candle, the flames go up.
Good.
And so it makes you think of God, that the
Okay. So what if I put on my Shabbat Shalom poster board arrows pointing up?
No.
I think a candle too symbolizes, well, to me, it's like a life that starts
Yes, you are
out.
correct.
life. It starts out full and gradually burns out.
Okay, that's a good point, but it's interesting because our sages do pick up on that, but they also point out that a flame is representative of your soul. There's actually a verse that says, Ner Hashem Nishmat Adam. The candle or the flame of God is the soul of man. There's a definite association between, that's why if somebody, God forbid, is sitting, mourning for somebody, they light a candle, a Yahrzeit candle, or a 7-day candle for Shiva, whatever it is. It's very, right? That's a classic Jewish symbol
Yeah.
because
And
that's
Elton John knew it
representative.
as well.
One.
Elton John knew it as well.
He stole a lot of stuff from us. He really did. But what many people are not aware, in its baseline law, the reason why we light candles for Shabbos is so that we can enjoy the Friday night meal with light. Remember, there's no electricity back then. You want candles. In the old days, came the nighttime, they went to sleep. That was the end because they were up at 4 in the morning getting ready for the next day. But Shabbos, I sit down to a nice meal. I want there to be peace and harmony. That's why they're actually association of the candles for Shabbos with Shalom Bayit, with harmony in the home. So you shouldn't fall and trip and bump into your spouse or bump into your kid or your kid bump into you. And then you really, like, hey, it's been a rough week, kid. Bug off. Right? So you want to have light. You want to have that. Yes, Anne.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Excuse me, Rabbi. I always believe somewhere I was taught somewhere that you're not supposed to use the Sabbath candles for light, for a light source.
So you might be confusing it with Hanukkah candles.
I don't know.
Hanukkah candles, we don't derive benefit. Shabbos candles, in fact, you really should benefit from.
I mean, yeah, I benefit. I think I know what you mean, but that it. I didn't think we could use it for light.
Yeah, that you
You
can get
can.
any and all benefit. In the
Okay.
old days, again, where they didn't have electricity, that was their source of light. And in fact, in many places, that might have been even their source of heat.
Oh, I'm learning.
Yeah, it's absolutely. In fact, that's one of the reasons, when you do it, right? How do you do it? Again, with Shabbos, you light them first, and then you make this magical three wave and you cover your eyes. Why? Why are you covering your eyes? You don't want to see them? Rabbi T just told you it's so good to see them. Why are you covering your eyes?
When you're praying to God.
You don't have to cover your eyes. I mean, we do it for Shema, for concentration. That might be an answer. But there's a specific reason. I'll show you that it's more than that. Because if the procedure is different for Yontif. For Yontif, you don't have to necessarily do it that way. But for Shabbos, we do. And it's for a simple reason. And that is, we have a rule. If you want to know step by step how to do a mitzvah, the first thing is you make the bracha. The second step is you perform the mitzvah, right? I'm about ready to eat my matzah at the Seder. I make a bracha. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Hamotzi lecha min haaretz. And then a second one, Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Asher kedeshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu al achilat matzah. And then I eat it. I don't eat it and then make the bracha. You always want to make the bracha, if you can, prior to doing the act. When I put on tefillin, I get it ready on my arm, then I say the bracha, and then I fasten it to my arm. Right? Bracha, then you do the action. Well, when it comes to Shabbos candles, you can't necessarily do that. I mean, if you're going to go ahead and make the bracha, you've now accepted upon yourself Shabbos. Asher kedeshanu b'tzivanu ner shel Shabbos. Now you can't light candles anymore. It's Shabbos. So what we do is we light them first, but I quickly cover my eyes so that I don't benefit from it. I make the bracha while I'm not looking at the candles. So in effect, I'm not benefiting yet. I then make the bracha and then I can enjoy it. I'm able to like almost circumvent the problem, and I'm going to still do a bracha before the action. You follow that? That's one of the reasons why the procedure is make the bracha, because you have to, otherwise you won't be able to light it afterwards. So you light it, then you cover your eyes and make the bracha so that you can get benefit from it. Randy, you're waiting patiently. Go ahead.
Is there any connection between lighting the Shabbos candles and the burning bush?
Yes, I don't know if it doesn't come to me as an immediate connection. This concept of a flame is
right.
The spirituality of this world. That's the idea that it's the soul of a person. God was coming to Moses in that burning bush. This was, so to say, the godliness, the spirituality of God coming down here on earth. So yeah, in that sense, yes. But
and there's a flame, and there's a flame within each one of us.
Correct. That's correct. But it's not directly, I can't think of a direct connection specifically to the burning bush. The concept that a flame represents that spirituality, that I'm totally on board with.
And the spirituality in your home on Shabbos.
Yeah, correct. That's exactly right. You want the sanctity that the house engenders to be focused on. The enlightenment of Torah values, of the fact that you're celebrating Shabbos. Yeah, that's connecting it to lighting a candle, the flame. It fits very much in line with what we're talking about. The same thing with the mezuzah, right? The mezuzah, the fence, is all there for both protection from physical and spiritual dangers from the outside world. Even going ahead on the night before Pesach, and we do what's called bedikas chametz, the search for chametz. You know, you put out your 10 Cheerios. Yeah. I don't know what they did before General Mills invented Cheerios. I don't know what they used, right? But the what it's conceptually, what are we doing? We are going around from room to room in our homes looking for where maybe I didn't have sanctity. Maybe a little chametz is growing here. I got to dispel that darkness. I have to periodically check if there are any foreign influences that succeeded in infiltrating in my house. I'm on a seek and destroy mission. That's part of the deeper meaning behind the search for chametz. And the list goes on, including the Hanukkah candles that we're going to light in a couple of weeks, God willing. The influence of the Jewish home can have on the outside world. Where do we light the Hanukkah candles? In our windows, facing the street. Why? Fascinating. We want the fact that our inner sanctum of holiness and values, we want that to shed light out into the dark world. We want people to see it and ask and say, wow, that's really cool. That's really impressive. How do I get a value system like this? Do you know that the windows in the temple were, from an engineering and architectural standpoint, reversed? All of our homes are all built that the windows should be absorbing, taking the sunlight from the outside and bringing it into our homes. That's how they are designed. The way they are, the shape and the angle and whatever it's meant to take from the outside in. The temple windows were designed in a way that the light of the menorah would shed outward, reflecting this concept. The sanctity in our homes has, let me say it better, the opportunity for having a home that is filled with sanctity not only does us good, does our family good, it does the world good. That's what we want ultimately. So Yossi ben Yoezer, getting back to our Mishnah here, because it's amazing how fast an hour goes. Yossi ben Yoezer says, let your home be a meeting place for the wise. Bring Torah into your home. It's good for you, it's good for your family, and it's good for the world. Not only should it just be there, you should be in the dust of their feet, which is such a great concept in and of itself. hear what they have to say. You know, when people are walking, they kick up dirt. You're traveling, right? What it means is follow them. Don't just say, well, I'm only going to come if they, you know, I'll only join the Torah class if it's in my house. If I have to go somewhere for it, I don't know about that, Rabbi. I don't know. No, be willing to go after them. Dust, kicking up dust, go for it. Sit at their feet. Listen to what they have to say. Not once, not twice, but on a regular basis. Which leads us to his third point. To drink thirstily of their words. I love this expression. How many of you love to drink water? Really, really enjoy it. I think many of us say no. Many of us do not enjoy it. Yes, we know it's healthy. We know it's good for the body, but it's not something we're jumping for joy to do. I have a very hard time drinking just water. Good. Marty, just trying to just dig it into me. I hear you. I'm assuming that's water unless it's, you know, sure. Okay. I like to put something in my water. It's hard for me. Okay. But you know when I love water, I can't get enough of it? When I'm thirsty. If I was playing sports and I worked up a real sweat, I can't wait. I don't want the soda. I don't want the Coke Zero. I don't want Diet Pepsi. I don't want any of that. I want a nice glass of ice cold water. Why? Because I'm thirsting for it. There's a real desire to have it. Otherwise, okay, I can live without it. Okay, so soda's mostly water. I could convince myself, rationalize it. Okay, I have diet, so it's not totally wasted calories, you know, but it's not the right thing. Water is definitely better. We need an attitude that I want to hear the words of Torah. I want to hear the value system that I should be a part of, but not I'm forced to do it. It's with a sense of thirst. I'm excited to hear it. You should imagine that you just came out of a desert and I'm offering you a glass of ice cold water. You want it? You sure do. You sure do. Every Wednesday night, come to this class at 7:50, 55, and come thirsty. You do. I'm not telling you what you're not doing, because otherwise you wouldn't be here. But it comes with a thirst. I want to hear this. This is important to me. I can't get enough of it. You need that attitude of wanting that thirst. There's a certain exuberance, a certain excitement, not just humdrum, been there, done that, okay. You need that vibrancy. You know, the Medrash tells us fascinating. Do you ever go fishing? Ever go fishing, like real fishing? I'm not talking about, you know, in the backyard. I mean, real fishing. And you ever get caught in the rain? You ever get caught in the rain fishing? No? Yes? Okay, Jeff Shager. There's interesting. Fish come up to the top of the surface and try to jump up and catch the drop of water. Do you know that? Not every fish, not every time, but there is definitely a more fish at the top wanting the new fresh water. The Midrash comments on that and says that's the how the Jewish people need to look at Torah. They may be surrounded by water. They may have heard many Dvar Torahs, many Torah insights over their years. And maybe they're even quite learned. But here's a fresh new drop. Someone wants to share a new thing. Ah, let me jump. Let me grab another one. Ah, delicious. Delicious. That's the way it should be. The first mitzvah in the Torah we were given as a people. What was the first mitzvah as a nation? Anybody? We were still in Egypt still.
The new moon?
Yes. Ding, 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 ding. Rosh Chodesh, the new moon. You know why it's called a Chodesh? You know what a Chodesh is? A month. Chodesh is a month. You know why it's called a month? Why the word for a month is Chodesh? Because it's Chadash. It's new. It comes around every 29 and a half days. There's a newness. There's a freshness. The Torah teaches the very first mitzvah we're given as a nation is HaChodesh HaZeh Lochem. Not just this month for you shall be the first of your months, referring to the month of Nisan, the month in which the Exodus took place. But on a deeper level, it's HaChidush HaZeh Lochem. This newness, this freshness, this vibrancy is what you need to be successful and survive as a nation. All of these things comes along our Mishnah. And Yossi ben Yoezer tells us, if you want to know how to get Torah in your home, it's a three-step process. One, bring it into your home, whether it's through the sages coming, their books, their videos, their TorahAnytime.com, whatever it is, bring it into your home. Create it. Number two is to sit at the dust of their feet. Take it in. Don't just buy the books and keep it on a shelf. I'm somewhat embarrassed. People come to my house and they see, thank God, I have a lot of Jewish books, a lot of Svarim. And they're like, wow, you've gone through all of these? And I'm like, very sheepishly, no. I can't even say I've gone through half of them. Okay, I read a chapter in this book and I use this as a reference for that. And okay, but there are definitely books that I haven't even cracked the binding on yet. Okay, that's not the way it's meant to be. If you're bringing Torah into your home, it's not there to be a nice bookmark or a nice shelf design or decor. It's meant to be learned. It's meant to be lived. And lastly, he says, but don't let it become familiarity breeds contempt. You have to drink thirstily. I heard once, you know, it doesn't say you should drink it as someone who's thirsty. Let's read the word carefully again. This will be the last thought, maybe. Read the word. Okay, in English, it's just, and drink thirstily. In Hebrew, it actually states it that way. The heve, I'm going to highlight it for you. I can get my mouse. Here we go. The heve shote batsama. And heve, you should. Shote means to drink. Batsama, not kitsama, like someone who's thirsty. It's not what it says. It says you shall drink it in thirst. The English translation is good here. Drink it thirstily, right? Always retain the thirst. Never quench it completely. Don't ever get to the point of where you say, I've done it. Well, how are you supposed to never get? Step by step. Take it in. I'm not going to go through all of Pirkei Avos in one night. One Mishnah. Take it in. Step. Incorporate it. The old days we used to say, let it percolate. My teenagers look at me and like, I have no idea what that word means. Right? Right? But you have to think about it. Yeah. Okay, I hear it. Oh, I got this question. Let me email him. Okay, fine. But you take it in. And then next week we take another step. You can't drink the entire ocean in one sitting. You always have to leave yourself a little room to quench your thirst. Here's the phrase, hard by the yard, cinch by the inch. That's how you have to approach your growth of Torah learning. If you want to grab the whole thing at one time, the whole yard, it's hard. It's hard to do that. But it's a cinch. It's really easy if you do it by the inch. Hard by the yard, cinch by the inch. That's how we have to do it. So this whole Mishnah, and we'll get to the second half, number five, Yossi ben Yochanan's teaching, but Yossi ben Yoezer, the first one, the Nasi, right? The executive branch here, he teaches us a three-tiered system of how to bring Torah into our homes, to make it real, to make it that our homes reflect the values that we do hold dear. Any questions, thoughts, comments? Yes, Fred.
At the beginning, you were talking about what was happening.
God, that was an hour ago. You can't hold me responsible for that.
At the beginning, you were talking about what the downfall of the temple was, and you mentioned one of the things you said were the arguments. There was no solid teaching, but people, in other words, the Hillel and Shammai had two schools that were, you know, right. Basically, I guess, opposite. But I always thought that's what scholars did, was to read something and try, especially the oral law, try to understand, or the written law, try to get a better understanding. And some would read it one way with the possibility that this could have been the meaning, and someone else reads it another way.
Yes.
And I thought through that, you're learning.
Yes, you are correct. You're 100% correct. However, let me ask you a simple question. When Moses taught the Torah to Joshua, was there anybody there to disagree?
Know where you're going with that. No.
Right. At some point, the game of telephone was now called into question. And yeah, I could look at it this way, and this seems to be a valid source, but I could also look, well, what did Moshe teach Yahushua? What did God teach Moshe? Which version of that story happened? You start to open up a little bit of Pandora's box. You're gonna rightfully, you're gonna turn it on me and say, yeah, so how do we know which version is right? Not for tonight. But the fact that there was a chink in the armor to allow that to come into play. That didn't happen for the first many, 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 many generations. Think about it this way, Fred. From the time of Mount Sinai to the destruction of the first temple was almost 1,000 years. The temple was built about 500 years after the giving of the Torah at Sinai, and it stood for 410. So that's already 910, plus the 70 years that we were in exile. That's 980. I mean, you're 1,000 years before Temple Two is on the scene. And all of that had no arguments, which is astounding. That's where things begin to unravel.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Susan.
I have a question and a comment. Which do you want first?
Comment comes before question.
Question,
T before Q.
okay, the comment is, I absolutely love, love, love the what I learned about having to exit, not from the door that you enter, and I will be marinating and percolating with that. It is so beautiful, and it's so relevant, and it was worth the price of
So if
admission.
Carl wants to know why you keep coming in the front door and going out the back door, now you can explain it. Okay.
Exactly. And the question is, the quote that you shared, Ner Tamid Nishmat. Adam, ner is the flame. Is that correct? Like,
It could
or is
be,
it,
it
or is
depends on
it
the
the light?
context.
Can it
Yes.
it's dependent on the context, because I
Yes.
always think of
Yeah.
or as light, and they're not necessarily interchangeable, correct? The flame and it's the
So it
context,
depends on
yeah.
the context. Ner, commonly known as a candle, but it's not the candle that's unlit. It's
Right,
the
right.
flame that is burning in the candle.
Yes, Ner Tamid would be an example.
Correct.
Right,
Correct.
okay.
But it's qualified. It's the eternal flame.
Okay, yeah.
So ner
And
depends. I use the analogy like when I use the word Torah. So, in the general sense, Torah is the full corpus of Judaic literature. But if I'm talking the five books of Moses versus the books of the prophets and the writings, that's also called Torah as opposed to Nevi'im and Ketuvim. So, you have to know the context. That's all. So, ner can work both ways.
and where is that quote from?
Ner Hashem Nishmat
Yes.
Adam, Proverbs.
A proverb? Okay. I'll look it up. I'll find it. Give me something to do.
It's not in the first three. I've been reviewing it recently. That much I'll tell you.
Thank you.
It's not, and it's not in the second to last one either.
Okay. That
Aren't you
leaves me
curious?
just
Aren't you curious how random that is?
to
Second to last? The penultimate one? It's because that's Eshet Chayil. That song.
Twentieth.
I'm pretty
It's the
familiar with
twentieth.
that song. It's not in there.
It's
Yes,
the
Rob.
20th. It's in the 20th parak of Mishle of
Oh, there you
Proverbs.
go. There you go. Thank you, Rabbi Dave. Chapter 20 of Proverbs.
Number
Yes, Rob.
20.
And I'm not sure if you can extrapolate this out of it, so that's why I'm going to ask. So, what we were just talking about, let your home be the meeting place. Can you extrapolate out of that that the home could also be the synagogue and could also be Israel?
Boom.
Israel also.
Excellent, Robin. There are commentaries that actually read that phrase exactly as you did. You know what your house should be? Your home should be where the sages gather. Make your home the Beit Midrash. Make your home the shul. Make your home where they actually meet and study. That's where you belong. I figured I wasn't going to go down that road, but hey, you brought it up. That's exactly how some learn it. This is how they used to tell us in yeshiva. But, you know, in the nicest possible way, they would say, Tachman, park it here. This is where your tukkas needs to be. This is, you know, your home should be the yeshiva. Your home needs to be where the sages gather. Not make your home the way I translated it tonight. Your home should be where the sages want to gather. But the home is your home. You're suggesting the opposite. You should be upplanted out of your home because your home really should be based in the Beit Midrash or the Beit Knesset, right? Exactly. There are many commentaries that learn it that way. Good job. Excellent, Robin.
Oh, thank you. And I also say, could it be
when
Israel?
When I'm not here over winter break, you'll cover for me?
Sure. Could the home also be Israel too, though, or is that taking it too far? Like, let your home, you know, the Jewish people, the home for the Jewish people.
Yeah, then what are you going to, by definition, then, what's the message?
Your home for the Jewish people be the meeting place, like that we're going to continue this as a country, as a people.
I don't know. I think that's a little bit of a stretch.
Okay. But you like the synagogue. The synagogue part's good.
The synagogue for sure. The yeshiva, the Beit Midrash, absolutely. Okay. That I'm totally on board with. What else? This is good. It generated a lot of good discussion here.
If Robin's taking over, then I'm going to have to take notes for Robin.
Oh, that's true. But somebody also has to do the Hebrew part.
Okay, fine. I still have a little job security. Okay, fine. Excellent. All right. I've held you hostage long enough. If nobody else has any questions, we'll call it a night and we'll meet again, God willing, next week. Good. All right. Thank you, everybody. Have a great
week.
Thank you. And I'll see you next week.
Thank you. Shalom, everybody.
Enjoy your dinner.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.